From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Less than 2 weeks ago, as Americans struggled to absorb images of four U.S. civilians burned and mutilated in the streets of Fallujah, New York Times correspondent John Burns filed a story that warned of a greater gathering threat. Beyond Fallujah, he wrote, the United States might be facing a war of national resistance in Iraq, a war in which bonds of Iraqi nationalism and Arab sensibility might transcend differences to unite angry Iraqis against U.S. troops. Within days, as a lightning-fast Shiite uprising roared along the Tigris and Euphrates, Burns' warning appeared terribly justified. The last 10 days have seen the most fiery combat since the U.S. invasion and high death tolls on all sides. And John Burns is still reporting. But now he's saying the shock of the last week may have sobered even Iraqis. Tonight on Point, New York Times correspondent John Burns on the turmoil in Iraq and the way ahead now. We talked just a few hours ago with John Burns in Baghdad. Burns is a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner and chief foreign correspondent for the New York Times. His report in the Times today conveys that Shiite firebrand Muqtada al-Sadr is being heavily lobbied by far more senior Shiite clerics to rein in his militia's uprising. Both American commanders and Iraq's Shiites may have been shocked into new perspectives by the blood and chaos of the last week, says Burns. Perspectives that may, in fact, promote stability. Because we taped this conversation earlier, we won't be able to take your calls tonight, and the quality of our phone connection to Burns in Baghdad was rough. But listen closely, and you will hear a great correspondent working to make sense of the world's most dangerous corner right now. I asked John Burns if this week's pause in fighting means last week's turmoil might have been just a speed bump on the road to a scheduled June 30th handover of power, or if something profound has changed or been revealed in Iraq.
I think it's a little early to tell. If you ask me for the probability, I would say that something profound has changed. That the insurgency we saw before has metastasized and it's becoming something else. It's not impossible that the American command here can turn this around, but we're right at a critical juncture here for the American enterprise.
How do you see the two paths, if things go well, if things don't go well?
Well, there's no doubt that the civilian and military leaders of the American occupation are right about one thing. The vast majority of Iraqis want to live in a free society. They want to have their own sovereign government, and they want to reach that end through elections. No question about it. Can the United States get back on that track, which was advancing with difficulty, but still advancing as recently as 2 weeks ago? Perhaps they can. Perhaps these events now with, as you know, I'm sure, on the American side, at least 80 soldiers dead in the past 12 days.
Yes.
On the Iraqi side, at least 1,000 dead, and I think that's probably a very conservative estimate, in Fallujah, Baghdad, Sadr City, and elsewhere. You know, is the wound too deep now to recover from? It's really difficult to tell. There are some very encouraging signs just within the last 24 hours. It looks as though Muqtada al-Sadr, the Shiite cleric who came out of Sadr City and precipitated this mayhem, it looks as though he is beginning to listen to the real hierarchy of the Shiite religion in Najaf. It's still not impossible that he will withdraw his troops and avoid a final confrontation with American troops. If he doesn't back down, and American troops felt obliged to go into Syria Najaf after him, then I think this ship, which has been taking on water, might very well sink. I don't think the Shiites, however much they want a democratic government, I don't think they will stand for American troops going into the holy city.
John Burns, I wonder if you can speak to the relationship there between Ayatollah al-Sistani and Muqtada al-Sadr. Today, of course, as you've reported, talks going on between high-ranking Shiite clerics and Muqtada al-Sadr. What leverage do they have with this fiery young cleric? How do their interests coincide or diverge?
Muqtada al-Sadr is not an important cleric. He's the son of an important cleric. He is the, if you will, he's the Kim Jong-il to Kim Il-sung of this affair. He is not much more than a religious student. he is held in great disdain by the men who are the true leaders of the Shiite faith. His father was assassinated in 1999 in very murky circumstances.
Yes.
And there's some contest as to who was responsible for that, whether it was Saddam Hussein's agents who seemed like the prime suspects, or it was agents of other Shiite clerics. But there's no question that if we look at it from the perspective of religion, Muqtada al-Sadr is a minor figure, made larger not just by his relationship to his father, but by the fact that he has weapons. Now, there's no doubt he's held in great disdain by the Shiite leaders, the Grand Ayatollahs, who are truly revered here, led by Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, who has stayed above the fray in this dispute over the last 12 days, except when he issued a fatwa, a statement, a decree last week for his aides, in which he said that whilst he sympathized with the cause and the motives of Muqtada al-Sadr, he couldn't have done otherwise with large numbers of Shiites in the streets under American guns, that he favored a peaceful solution. That was a statement much favored by the American commander, by Paul Brunner, the chief civilian administrator here at the time. Now, Sistani went a very important step further by sending his own son last night, that's Monday night, to Muqtada al-Sadr's headquarters in Najaf at the head of a delegation of extremely important Shiite clerics to try and persuade him to stand down, to try and work out a formula, and this is the essential issue, to stand his militia down, but more importantly, to come to some kind of understanding with the Americans about the question of this arrest warrant. And there is an available compromise on that issue. The compromise would be, as I understand it, from talking to people on the Iraqi Governing Council, which is a body appointed as an advisory body by the United States last year, and now the nucleus of a proposed transitional government. Adnan Pachici, who is perhaps the most reliable, responsible, and pro-American member of the IGC, as it's called here, suggested to me at the weekend that there are ways around this issue in Iraqi law, that you can defer the serving of a warrant or the execution of a warrant, and that this could be deferred until an Iraqi sovereign government is in power and it can then make the decision itself. That means to, if you will, pump this whole issue beyond June the 30th.
In other words, to step back from the threat to capture or kill Muqtada al-Sadr, actually put that into some kind of limbo so that he would have room to negotiate to stand down.
That's correct. And it's pretty clear to me that that is the nature of the proposed stand down. But the Americans will not accept that, I'm sure, unless he stands his militia down. His position, we learned today, on that issue, as discussed last night in Najaf, was that he wants the other clerics to order him to stand his militia down. This is quite clever. Their response is, you didn't ask us when you formed your militia, so why should our word now be required to have you disband it? There are very, very difficult issues here, which have to do with the fact that there is more than one Shiite clerical militia. And my feeling is that Ayatollah al-Sistani and Mr. al-Hakim of Spiri, with his Badr Brigade militia, have seen that there are grave dangers to the Shiite majority population in Iraq of an internecine conflict between those two militias. It happened before, in the 1920s, when the British took control of Iraq after the First World War. Shiite militias, Shiite groups and gangs went to war with each other at that time, and the result, which is probably inevitable for other reasons anyway, was that the Sunni minority in Iraq took power and remained in power until the fall of Saddam Hussein. So Shiites are very aware of history and what can happen if they fight amongst themselves. So you have Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, you have just about the entire hierarchy of the Shiite faith saying to Muqtada al-Sadr, in the interest of the Shiites of this country, step down, step back, let the Americans go ahead with their formula, let us get peace peacefully, and let's avoid shooting at each other.
So, John Burns, that means the Shiites talking among themselves today in Iraq may be pulling this back from the edge. What about the American position? Is it going to have to change? Are officials there going to have to be more open to a religiously oriented government or more powerful Shiite voice?
The United States, of course, would regard the accession of a militant government in Iraq, especially one backed and closely associated with the Ayatollahs in Tehran, as being one of the worst possible outcomes. Not the worst possible outcome, but one of the worst possible outcomes of this crisis. You can imagine such a government which would govern much as Iran has been governed, you would at least have largely peace, even if you had hostility to the United States. But they clearly would prefer that it not be an Islamic government, and they've been relying on the emergence of a secular voice within the Shiites to stand up. There's not much sign of that, I have to say. In the streets, yes, just anecdotally, walking around the cities of Iraq, it's pretty plain that at rest, when things aren't volatile, many, many Shiites do not want an Islamic government, especially don't want an Islamic militant government. But when you have this kind of turmoil, they tend to fall in behind their religious leaders. It's not as if Mr. Bema and the generals don't know the formula here. They know very well the risks that are involved. They have a program for a transitional government, for the election of the National Assembly, for that assembly to draft a permanent constitution and elections, all of this to bring, as you know, a elected Iraqi government into power by January 2006.
Yes.
It's a very bumpy road to that moment. It was a bumpy road before all this began because the Shiite majority, through the Ayatollahs mostly, is very wary of having the Shiite majority that they've waited for so long, for a century, in effect, under Sunni minority rule. They're very wary of having that stolen away from them by a constitution which has elaborate minority guarantees. That was the problem before all this happened. I have a feeling, and this may be to see things from too rosy a point of view, but it is possible
yes.
that in the shock of the last 10 or 12 days, they have seen that there is something worse than an American-inspired transitional constitution with elaborate minority rights for the Sunnis and the Kurds. What's worse than that would be a three-cornered civil war, the Americans leaving, Shiites divided, Sunnis probably not divided, and history could repeat itself. So it could be, to take a rosy view, that out of all of this, there could be something better that emerges. As you know, the Chinese have a saying that out of all things good, something bad, out of all things bad, something good. Having lived many years in China myself, I thoroughly subscribe to that, especially the second part of it. I think that something good could come out of this. I think that the Shia community in Iraq, having waited this century, this whole century, and in some ways centuries before that, the Ottoman period of the Ottoman Empire, for Shiites to gain their rightful inheritance as they see it, that is to say, majority rule in this corner of the Arab world, that they could lose it if they allow Muqtada al-Sadr to promote chaos.
Do you take from all that, that though Paul Bremer over the weekend was himself calling the situation in Iraq a crisis, has the overall steady-as-she-goes determination of Washington then been vindicated here?
I think we have to ask ourselves what alternatives there are for the United States in all of this. I think there's pretty general agreement, and as far as I can tell, looking at the presidential election in the United States from a distance, that there's pretty broad agreement in the Congress, and certainly between President Bush and his opponent, that there is no quick exit here, that this has to be made to work, or as they say in the Apollo 13 jargon of our times, failure is not an option. In those circumstances, when this crisis developed, I think that the things that we saw were inevitable. It was a very deep crisis, a profound crisis. I think there were times at which the United States military was at risk of being overwhelmed here. They, I think, managed their way through this very effectively. It may well be that in time we will judge that there was an overreaction in Fallujah. We really do not know yet. It's beginning to look as if there was. We have not been able to get into Fallujah to judge for ourselves whether that is the case. But on the whole, I think faced with a profound crisis like this, that it has been managed relatively effectively, and stability is beginning to return now. It could very well be that this crisis will turn worse for the worse again, and that will prove to be mission impossible.
We're talking this hour with John Burns, chief foreign correspondent at the New York Times. We taped this conversation a few hours ago, so we're not able to take your calls this hour. The line to Baghdad was rough, but listen closely, and you will hear a great correspondent working to make sense of a tumultuous 10 days. We'll be right back with more of John Burns. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with New York Times correspondent John Burns. He joins us from Baghdad. John, just before the break, we were talking about the lessons learned by the Shiite community in the last few days. And, of course, today, with the Shiites sitting down with Muqtada al-Sadr, perhaps looking to find a way to be more cooperative with the United States in their own interests. Let me ask you this. In all the uproar and shock and killing and hints of popular uprising almost in the last couple of weeks, what lessons do you think the United States has learned?
Well, it would be presumptuous for me to remind the American occupation authority here that they are walking in a minefield. They already knew that. They did tread on a couple of mines. Those were avoidable enough. We'll let history decide. But if you ask me, I think that closing down the newspaper of Muqtada al-Sadr after allowing it to operate for the past year, issuing an arrest warrant for Muqtada al-Sadr in the murder that occurred 24 hours after Baghdad was liberated by American troops last year, when they had let him run free for a year, knowing very well, as we now know, that he was involved in that murder right from the start.
Right.
I think you'd have to question whether that was a wise judgment. You could go back and say perhaps they should have arrested him earlier, they should have closed that newspaper earlier, but in any case, it looks like a case of going softly, too softly to begin with, and then too hard later on. On the other side of the equation in Fallujah, my guess is that there are very large lessons to be learned there. The 82nd Airborne Division, which had responsibility for that area for much of the past year, had decided by the turn of the year that Fallujah was in many respects a kind of no-go area, that they handed over authority, the responsibility for the security of Fallujah, to the notables of the town, if you will,
yes,
mostly to tribal sheikhs. So much so did they do this that when there was a raid on the police station by the insurgents 7 or 8 weeks ago on a police station in Fallujah, probably the biggest single raid of its kind mounted by the insurgents, in which 20 or 30 suspects, that's to say insurgent detainees, were released. At that time, the 82nd Airborne, on bases only a few miles outside the town, did not advance into the town in support of the Iraqi civil authority. All we did, and they told us so quite clearly at the time, was they were asked for ammunition. They delivered ammunition to the Iraqis at the edge of the town, and they let them get on with it. They were very content that they'd handled that correctly. The Marine Corps came in the annual troop rotation, took over responsibility for the Fallujah area formally on March the 24th, and then went to war. Before the four Americans in Fallujah were attacked, murdered, mutilated, or hanged from the bridge, the Marines had already been at war in Fallujah for about a week with major battles, major engagements with the insurgents. The murder of the four security guards, American security guards, followed upon that, and then the Marines decided to go in full strength, siege the town, and so forth. Now, I think that needs to be addressed as well.
What lesson do you take from that then, John, that the hands-off approach invited flouting of the law of the authorities, or that the heavier Marine approach was too heavy, or something in between?
Do you know, I think it would be presumptuous for me to say which was the wiser approach. All I am saying is that they weren't both correct. That is to say, if standing back was right in January, February, I don't see how going in strong can have been right in March and April. And maybe some sort of combination of the two, but certainly there were signals given to the people of Fallujah, to the insurgents, you might say, which perhaps were the wrong signals in not going in hard enough. It's very easy for us to judge this. As I said, this is a minefield. If the 82nd Airborne stayed out, it was probably because they realized that this kind of conflagration could occur. The Marines are, as we were told when they came in here, a different corps with a different tradition, and they proved to be a lot tougher about this. What the lessons are, I hesitate to say, but there clearly are lessons in all of this to be learned, and I'm quite sure that they are being learned right now. A couple of miles from where I'm sitting in the American headquarters here in Baghdad and in the Pentagon.
John Burns, as we talk today, has the U.S. come close to its goal of seeking to end the role of Fallujah as a base for Sunni insurgents, or is that going to require more days of fighting, more hundreds of Iraqi casualties scores of American casualties?
I would say the answer to that is twofold. No, they have not come close to ending the role of Fallujah as a base for the insurgency. And no, I don't think there is an option, myself, politically, to resume the offensive as it was being carried out before the weekend. We do not know really yet the full extent of the toll within Fallujah. There is no doubt some clouding of this by the insurgents themselves. But we know that the death toll has been very high. How many of them were insurgents and how many civilians, we're not sure. But you only have to visit the hospitals in Baghdad to see that there have been a lot of civilian casualties, including women and children. I think the attention given to that aspect of this, even if it's been disproportionate, is probably so great and has been so provocative to this very volatile public opinion in Iraq that I don't think it's an option to continue it. I think the insurgents in Fallujah know that, and knowing that, they may consider that they've scored some kind of a victory here.
So then, after these days of terrible fighting, and with your observation, the U.S. will probably conclude it cannot go back in the same way, that heavy way. Our U.S. interests, the U.S. goal of a handover of power, of progress toward a democratic Iraq, advanced by what's happened in the last week, 10 days, or not?
I think absolutely not. I think that's very clear. I think that the situation that was tenuous 10 days to 2 weeks ago became quickly extremely perilous. I'm speaking also from a personal point of view. Our personal situation, which is a kind of bellwether of the wider situation for the United States enterprise here, became very quickly, seriously imperiled. Journalists here, all foreigners here. Clearly, the last 2 weeks has not been an advance. There are major questions now as to whether this enterprise can be gotten back on track. And it may be, to be fair, only that what we've seen in the last 2 weeks has proven that this risky journey on which the United States embarked a year ago is ultimately beyond accomplishment. It never could have been accomplished. If they do accomplish it, in the face of all these odds, it will have been, of course, a famous, famous victory for the United States and for the cause of democracy. To build a civil society in this country after the 35 years of Saddam Hussein was, I'm sure all Americans would agree, a worthy goal. But I think the events of the last 2 weeks have raised questions that were already paramount here. Is it a doable thing? And if it is not a doable thing, if in the end this is not simply not the kind of ground on which, from which a civil society can grow at this point, what then is the alternative to the United States? And that is a question of enormous complexity that I hardly dare to address.
The U.S. has today, again, talked about bringing in more troops. Are more troops an interim answer? Are they a necessity to keep order at this point?
I think the answer is they are a necessity. We were told repeatedly from last April on, repeatedly, this question was raised by reporters here of the American commanders. Do you have enough troops? It seemed evident to us in the first weeks after Baghdad fell to the American forces that there simply were not enough troops to maintain order. I think that's generally recognized now. But as time went on, the question kept coming up, and it came up because our own trips across the country suggested to us that the United States was a long way from having effective security control over this country. They were in control of the areas where they were at any one time. When they weren't there, somebody else was in control, and it was very often the insurgents. Now, of course, we're told in the last 2 weeks, having been told for a year, that there were adequate forces here. Now we're told by General Abizé, General Sampras, and others that there are not adequate forces, that they need two brigades of combat troops here. I see there's some discussion as to whether this means 10,000 or 25,000 additional
yes.
troops.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be enough? Let me just tell you that a senior general that I spoke to only yesterday acknowledged that there was a fundamentally unstable situation in Baghdad itself over the past week. We knew this because having once decided that there was no trip outside Baghdad that was safe for us, we would therefore stay within Baghdad, we then discovered to our consternation from about Thursday last week on, that there was no trip inside Baghdad that was safe either. The United States has, I'd be telling the truth if I knew exactly how many troops, but somewhere in the order of 25,000 to 30,000 troops in the Baghdad area. And they were not in full control of Baghdad last week. That was plain. The Sadr people were substantially for a long time in command of Sadr city, up on the northeastern fringe of the city, on the western edge of the city towards Fallujah, in Sunni areas of the city, in places like Adamiya, Abu Ghraib, which is really not anything more than a western suburb of Baghdad. It was clear the United States forces were not in control. And if they're not in control of the capital, not fully in control of the capital, then how stable and how secure is American authority in this country? Not at all, I would say. Now, they moved out quickly with the troops, which meant that they had to pull troops out of the Baghdad garrison. They retook some of the smaller towns which had fallen to Muqtada al-Sadr's militiamen. They've stabilized the situation in the south. They've stabilized the situation in Baghdad. But as this general said to me, stable is one thing, secure is another. That will take some time to accomplish. I have to say, Tom, that many of us who've seen the whole sweep of this from the last year of Saddam Hussein through until now, we're not military experts, but we felt that trying to take control of a country of 25 million people the size of France with 130,000 troops, of whom, as you know, at any one time, I would think possibly half to two-thirds are not combat troops.
Yes.
Certainly a very large proportion of them are not. Even those who are combat troops, many of them are involved in force protection, that's to say, defending their own bases, defending themselves, didn't seem to us like an adequate force. I mean, we had numbers bandied around, as you remember, at the time of the invasion, that something more like 500,000 men might have been capable of doing this.
Right.
You have to feel for the generals who are here with this problem on their hands, with so few forces, obliged to say, I would guess, in public, to reporters here, we have adequate troops. They could never have given us any other answer than that. But it must be a devilishly difficult thing to cope with this.
John, let me ask...
How much they must wish now that they had another 100,000 troops.
Let me ask you then, you were saying earlier that in some degree all of Iraq looked into the chasm last week and saw how bad things could be, particularly the Shiites. Is it possible that that large Shiite majority and the clerics who lead it, Muqtada al-Sadr aside or perhaps even reined in, will now pull in behind the American mission here, will now be more committed, having seen how badly things could go, to helping float this mission towards some kind of successful outcome?
I think, Tom, that's a very probable conclusion. I think you've seen very clearly. My guess is that the most important meeting that has taken place in Iraq for many, many months was the one last night when those Ayatollahs went to see Muqtada al-Sadr. I think they did look over into the abyss. I think that they realized what lay ahead if they went that way, and they've stepped back. And although they would not see it that way, they have become once again, in effect, allies of the United States in trying to move this country towards some sort of peaceful solution, some sort of civil society. I think it's probably too much to speak of a truly democratic society, but certainly some kind of a society where the deep divisions here that we've seen exposed in the last week, the deep divisions of an ethnic, sectarian nature, religious nature, can be bridged. What kind of a government that will be, who can tell? And it's going to be very, very difficult. But my guess is that it's been a shock to everybody. I know it's been a shock to every Iraqi I've spoken to. I've looked into many, many eyes that I know well here in the past few days, and what I've seen is deep, deep fear.
Let me ask you, John, is there an answer to that feeling on the Sunni side? Or are the Sunnis so upset over their future minority status in a democracy that they're going to be dead-enders, that they're going to be fighting this all the way?
It's a major conundrum that the Sunnis have continued to fight when it seems to many of us that with the capture of Saddam Hussein, a retreat to the past was gone. There is going to be no restoration of a Saddamist government here, nor of a Ba'athist government. And it looked in December when Saddam was captured, it looked to me as though cool heads in the Sunni community would begin to prevail, and they might begin to see the United States military here, so far from being their worst enemy, might be the guarantor for them, and so far as there is any guarantee, of a secure future, because only under the aegis of the United States Armed Forces was there ever any hope of there being a constitution agreed here which would guarantee minority rights, including the rights of Sunnis. It's as if the Sunni insurgents had been knocking the pins out from under their own future, in my view. And there were some times, some weeks ago, that imams in Ramadi and Fallujah, tribal sheikhs, were beginning to understand this. And I personally thought that it was possible that the Sunnis could begin to do a major U-turn, a major course correction,
yes,
and come to see that attacking the United States Armed Forces was leading them towards the chasm. Now, we've not seen that turnaround, but perhaps Fallujah will be the same kind of a shock. Perhaps the shock that has been, it's been a shock to all three components in this, certainly to the Shiites, certainly to the Americans, and I would think to the Sunnis as well. And perhaps out of all of this, cooler heads on all sides will now prevail, and there will be some good news from Iraq for us to report over the next few weeks, and let's hope it's so.
And John, we just have a minute left. I need to ask you about U.S. troops there. We've seen photographs and TV in the last 2 weeks where they appear to be in extreme duress. What's your observation about the morale and conditions of U.S. combat troops in Iraq now?
Well, I have to say, first of all, that I'm not the best person to speak to because I have not been embedded. I have been embedded, in a sense, with Mr. Muqtada al-Sadr's militia because I was taken hostage by them.
Yes.
Last week, fortunately, for not very long. So I can't speak to that. What I can speak to is the mood amongst the commanders, and the moods at headquarters bases and elsewhere. And I suppose this is an oblique answer, but perhaps in the circumstances it's answered enough. I think the United States does actually have reason, and I say this as a citizen of the United Kingdom, does have reason to be deeply proud of its armed forces. I cannot tell you what happened at Fallujah, and it may well be that there are serious lessons to be learned there. Perhaps there was too great an application of force. I don't know. Perhaps there wasn't. But I felt that the United States, for its $400 billion a year, has got armed forces of which it can be extremely proud. I have seen them again and again, under duress, going the extra mile to help victims of this conflict, to do everything they can to alleviate the suffering and misery of people. I think that the generals are smart, intelligent people who have drawn all the lessons that we learned from the disaster in Vietnam. They're a new generation of generals. My guess is that no country could have fielded a more effective fighting force than the United States has done here. Whether they can get the job done or not is another question.
John Burns, we're very grateful for your time with us this evening and for all your reporting there out of Iraq. Thank you so much. Be safe, and we look forward to speaking with you again.
It's been a pleasure, Tom. Thank you very much.
In a moment, Louis Free, Janet Reno, John Ashcroft, and the 9/11 Commission. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Today's installment of the 9/11 Commission hearings featured testimony from former FBI Director Louis Free, former Attorney General Janet Reno, and current Attorney General John Ashcroft, front and center in the questioning today, the failings of the FBI. The Commission heard today that the Bureau focused on prosecuting known terrorists, not finding the next generation, that it didn't have enough money to hire Arabic and Farsi linguists, that it had known since 1996, since the 96 Olympics, that planes could be used as weapons but had not incorporated that knowledge into security planning. And then there was John Ashcroft pushing blame for 9/11 squarely onto the Clinton administration. Joining me now is Michael Isikoff, Newsweek's investigative correspondent who was at today's hearings. Good evening and welcome, Michael Isikoff.
Good evening. It's good to be with you.
It's good to have you. And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Michael.
Mike and Jack, let's hear a bit right off the bat from Attorney General John Ashcroft. He was tough today, and toughest of all on the Clinton administration, implicitly blaming them for the 9/11 attacks. He said at one point, quote, "For nearly a decade, our government had blinded itself to our enemies." And he blasted the previous administration for setting up what he called a legal wall to separate criminal investigations from intelligence agents.
The memorandum ordered FBI Director Louis Free and others, quote, "We believe that it is prudent to establish a set of instructions that will more clearly separate the counterintelligence investigation from the more limited but continued criminal investigations. These procedures, the memo went on to say, which go beyond what is legally required, will prevent any risk of creating an unwarranted appearance that FISA is being used to avoid procedural safeguards which would apply in a criminal investigation. Now, this memorandum laid the foundation for a wall separating the criminal and intelligence investigations, as a matter of fact, established the wall following the 1993 World Trade Center attack, which at the time was the largest international terrorism attack on American soil, the largest prior to September 11th. Although you understand the debilitating impact of the wall, I cannot imagine that the Commission knew about this memorandum, so I have had it declassified for you and the public to review. Full disclosure compels me to inform you that the author of this memorandum is a member of the Commission.
Attorney General John Ashcroft today before the 9/11 Commission. Michael Isikoff, a fascinating bit of accusation and kind of internal drama right there.
I'd call it a brushback pitch by Ashcroft. He came expecting that he was going to get hit because there was some pretty tough evidence that the commission had developed, suggesting he was not entirely on top of the terrorist threat prior to 9/11. There had been some testimony from the former interim director of the FBI, Tom Picard, suggesting that although he briefed Ashcroft a couple of times on Al-Qaeda, on the Al-Qaeda threat prior to 9/11, at one point Ashcroft said he didn't want to hear any more about it, and that in a budget document, a planning document that was on in May of 2001, Ashcroft had left terrorism off the list of FBI budget priorities. The Dale Watson, the former head of counterterrorism for the FBI, said he had almost fallen off his chair when he read the budget planning document. So Ashcroft was fully expecting to get hit with all this when he came in, and he decided, as is John Ashcroft's wont, that he was going to play hardball and go right back at the commission and go after one of the Democratic commissioners, Jamie Karelek, with this by declassifying this memo that she had written that helped erect this wall between intelligence and criminal investigators, which has been cited as one of the barriers that had prevented the FBI from fully investigating the terrorist threat prior to 9/11.
So here, Jack, John Ashcroft, out of gallbladder surgery, but still plenty of gall, throwing what Michael Isikoff calls a brushback pitch, referring to this 1995 document that one of the commission members was engaged apparently in drafting, but in the process, really going after the kind of meticulous civil liberties protections that I guess that was supposed to have represented, and saying we needed the gloves off here, and we finally got them off with the Patriot Act.
Yes, he said that it's a time for painful introspection. He engaged in none of it on his own account. He meant that the Clinton administration should engage in that, or its former members. This was a strategic strike right at them. Later on, in an interview, Jamie Karelek said, well, if he was conscious of the wall, he did nothing in the 8 months he was attorney general to take it down. And the fact is, both of them were in the world before both the memo and Attorney General Ashcroft's hesitation about taking the wall down. Both decisions belonged to the world before 9/11. That was the world, and I'm sure Michael Isikoff must have felt a bit of it today when he was, you know, channeling Lucian Goldberg and Linda Tripp, and we were getting ready to impeach President Clinton over lying about sex. So that was a different world.
Michael Isikoff, what's your main takeaway from the testimony today? We'll hear more tape, but where does this leave the commission's work?
Well, they've done the bulk of, I think, their looking at the responses of the various government agencies. George Tenet, the CIA director, is testifying tomorrow. He's got some tough questions to answer. In fact, there was some pretty damning evidence in one of the commission staff reports today about CIA failures on to pass along evidence it had developed about Khalid Al-Madar in Nawaz Nawaf al-Hazmi, who were the two of the hijackers who came into the country after attending a Malaysia summit meeting, Al-Qaeda summit meeting in January 2000. It was monitored by the CIA. These guys flew off to Los Angeles, ended up living in a room they rented from an FBI informant, and none of the information was ever passed along by the CIA. It was probably the most egregious intelligence failure that preceded 9/11. The CIA has never been really closely questioned about it. There were a couple of questions for Kofor Black, the former head of the Counterterrorism Center at the CIA today. Tenet's going to take the stand tomorrow. And I would expect that he'll get some tough questions about this. But beyond that, the one that I'm really looking for, and I think is going to be the one that is going to get a lot of attention, is the hearing in May on the 9/11 plot itself, what the commission has been able to learn about exactly what was involved in the plot, who was involved, who financed it, what connections it would have to various other parties. There's a lot we still don't know about that. What the government does know now about the 9/11 plot, and I think that's going to be probably the next stage, the next big thing to look for in these commission hearings.
There was a lot of attention paid today to failures of communication within and between the FBI and others. Former Attorney General Janet Reno said that while the FBI is filled with competent workers, she said there are systematic problems of information sharing that became evident to her as soon as she entered office.
I've seen so many in action. I've seen them do incredible things. I've seen them risk their lives. And I have a profound respect for all the people that I have worked with in the Bureau. But quickly, when I came into office, I learned that the FBI didn't know what it had. We found stuff in files here that the right hand didn't know what the left hand was doing. And it was obvious that the development of a computer system and a system of automation would be very helpful to it. But it was also important for people to begin to look at manually what they could do to find out what they had and what they didn't have. And we proceeded in that direction.
Michael Isikoff, so much today about this information mess at the FBI and between the FBI and other agencies. Was it as bad as all that? Is that what's emerging here? Has it been fixed?
Well, it certainly was as bad. In fact, it's worse. I mean, there are so many egregious examples of things that were out there in various field offices and in FBI files that were never passed along. Tom Picard, who was the interim director of the FBI, said he didn't know about the Moussaoui case. The CIA director, George Tenet, knew about Moussaoui's arrest in Minneapolis by FBI agents that the FBI director at the time didn't know. He didn't know about the search for al-Nidar and al-Hazmi, the two hijackers I was just talking to, who were at FBI office in New York, is finally alerted in late August. The director of the FBI at the time isn't informed. The Phoenix memo about Middle Easterners taking flight school lessons never goes up the chain to the FBI. So there's a lot there. There was also, I just want to point out, in terms of the quality of FBI information,
yes,
some pretty startling testimony about that President's daily brief that was released over the weekend,
the August 6th briefing,
2001, that went to President Bush, supposedly in response to a request by the president about what is known about al-Qaeda activities in the United States. You may remember in that brief, it reports 70 full field investigations by the FBI into Bin Laden related.
A big number.
Tom Picard, the interim director at the time, testified today. Not only did he not know about the president's daily brief and wasn't consulted about the preparation for it, even though it came from his own agency.
Whoa.
He said today that 70 full field investigations was an inaccurate number. It was exaggerated. It didn't really refer to 70 investigations. It may have referred to some individuals. He gave a breakdown. Some of it, in fact, involved the embassy bombing case, which was already had already concluded. I mean, that's pretty eye-popping when you take a step back and say the President of the United States asks for a document to give him a brief on what is known by his government, and the information passed along by the FBI isn't even accurate.
It sounds like it's just popping up out of a bureaucratic process that no one's really on top of.
Yeah, I found that probably the single most startling thing, that the information provided to the president in response to his own request was wrong. And when you look at the whole document itself, it's a pretty lame, tepid document.
There was another interesting moment today when Commissioner Richard Benveniste asked Louis Free, a former FBI head, if the FBI had been aware that terrorists might use airplanes as weapons in a terrorist attack. Let's listen.
Did this subject of planes as weapons come up in planning for security of the Olympics held in Atlanta in 1996?
Yes, I believe it came up in a series of these, as we call them, special events. These were intergovernmental planning strategy sessions and operations. And I think in the years 2000, 2001, even going back maybe to the 2000 Olympics, that was always one of the considerations in the planning, and resources were actually designated to deal with that particular threat.
So it was well known in the intelligence community that one of the potential areas or devices to be used by terrorists, which they had discussed according to our intelligence information, was the use of airplanes either packed with explosives or otherwise in suicide missions.
That was part of the planning for those events. That's correct.
And so the notion of planes as weapons in the air. And yet what may linger here, Jack, in part, is this exchange between Tom Pickering, the interim head of the FBI, and John Ashcroft with very different interpretations today, under oath, on the record. Pickering saying that John Ashcroft had said he didn't need to hear any more about Osama bin Laden. Ashcroft saying just the opposite.
Yes, both under oath, one of them was lying, neither one of them said, it's my recollection. Both said flat out, I did or I didn't say that. I did or I didn't hear that. So you have to say, well, who would have the motive to lie? Well, Picard is a retired FBI official, and John Ashcroft is an active politician with designs on the presidency someday. I don't know what that says, but I found that a very striking moment where you actually have on the record two people take an oath and one of them clearly wasn't telling the truth.
Michael Isikoff, we just have a minute left, but your sense of John Ashcroft's overall performance today, how it was received and how it will affect the overall commission inquiry?
Well, I was a little surprised, actually, that the questioning wasn't more aggressive and didn't focus more on that discrepancy that Jack just referred to and some of the others in the staff statements. I have to say, I think that the brushback pitch I referred to earlier may have had an effect because, for one thing, it sort of neutralized Jamie Gorelick, who is one of the Democratic commissioners and
yes,
probably one of the more effective questioners on the commission. But I was a little surprised that some of the other commissioners didn't go after Ashcroft more on this. Maybe it was because of he came on so strong and they didn't want to look quite that partisan, or maybe it was just late in the day, but some of these contradictions were not focused on as much as I expected they were going to be.
Well, we will continue watching. Michael Isikoff, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Anytime.
Michael Isikoff with Newsweek magazine, and Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.